Welcome to Fronteras, a Changing America. I'm your host, Vanessa Dalbovich. At rallies in San Diego and across the country this week, activists called on the U.S. Justice Department to finish its long-standing investigation into the 2010 death of a Mexican immigrant at the hands of Border Patrol agents. From our Fronteras desk, Adrian Florido says the renewed pressure from activists comes after a new video has emerged that calls into question the agent's version of what happened.
In May of 2010, 42-year-old Anastasio Hernandez Rojas lay brain dead in a San Diego hospital. The day before, U.S. Border Patrol agents had caught him trying to illegally cross the border back into San Diego, where he'd lived and raised a family for almost 3 decades before being deported. The agents said Rojas got violent with them, forcing them to use a stun gun to subdue him. He died in the hospital. This eyewitness video emerged shortly after the incident. It was shot through a fence surrounding the area at the border used to process deportees. It doesn't show much, but you can hear Rojas's anguished cries for help. The video led Rojas's family to question border agents' claims that they tased him in self-defense. The San Diego County coroner ruled his death a homicide, but 2 years later, no one's been charged. Recently, though, a border activist and documentary filmmaker tracked down a second video of the incident. It was shot by a pedestrian standing on a bridge overlooking the spot where Rojas was tased. And the video offers much clearer footage of what happened. It's a recent Friday evening, and about 100 people, including Rojas's widow and brother, are gathered at the San Diego offices of a progressive advocacy group. They're here to watch the new video, which PBS broadcast in a recent episode of its news magazine, Need to Know. The video shows about 20 uniformed Border Patrol and Customs agents surrounding Rojas. They're yelling for him to stop resisting, even though he's laying virtually motionless on the ground. One agent takes out a stun gun and shocks Rojas several times. People nearby scream. Then several agents descend on him before the video ends.
No man, no human being should be treated with the indignity and the brutality that Anastasio was treated.
Cristian Ramirez leads a coalition of activists along the U.S.-Mexico border. He says they're launching a national campaign, holding rallies and collecting signatures. They want to know why the Justice Department has yet to complete an investigation it launched shortly after the incident. Activist and filmmaker John Carlos Frey explained why he tracked the video down.
So I'm hoping that the video shows proof that Anastasio did not die of unnatural causes and that he was probably killed by Border Patrol agents unnecessarily.
A San Diego Border Patrol spokeswoman refused to comment on the case, citing the pending federal investigation. But here in San Diego, Maria Puga, Rojas's widow, says she wants to see those who took her husband's life held accountable. She says her 5 children still struggle to understand what happened to their father, who built swimming pools in San Diego and liked taking his kids to the beach. Who knows what those people were thinking at that moment, she says. They were very cruel. I want there to be justice. People like Juventino Flores are doing what they can to help. He wrote a Norteño ballad for his childhood friend a week after he died, and now he's performing it for audiences. More than 15 uniformed men, he sings. They beat his already still body. But this week, as activists organized events nationally, a growing number of people took to the streets, saying they were determined to tell what Anastasio Hernandez Rojas could not. In San Diego, I'm Adrian Florido.
As the number of Spanish speakers grows across the country, public services must keep up with critical translation needs. But paying for interpreters and translators isn't easy in a time of recession. In Nevada, one place where the strain is evident is the state's cash-strapped court system. Reporter Jude Joffe Block spent some time with court interpreters in Las Vegas to find out what they're up against.
It's midday, and Carol Partigian is rushing to an appointment at the Clark County Jail downtown. She's the only Spanish language interpreter in the county public defender's office, which means she's usually in a hurry.
With the 100-plus attorneys that we have in the office, it's very hard for one person to be able to help everybody.
Last year alone, those 100-plus public defenders handled roughly 4,000 to 5,000 cases with Spanish-speaking defendants, about 30% of their caseload. They need more help, more staff interpreters, but there's no money to pay them. Inside the jail, Partigian waits in a small room with public defender Steve Yeager for a guard to bring in his client.
We really wouldn't have all that much to talk about if Carol weren't here. I mean, I speak some Spanish, but obviously not. I'm not fluent, so it would probably leave us just looking at each other and trying to communicate.
The inmate comes in wearing a blue uniform. Yeager begins chatting, and Partigian jumps in, switching from English to Spanish, Spanish to English, trying to choose the equivalent words in each language.
Has somebody interviewed you yet?
The client's sentencing date for a minor drug offense is coming up, and Yeager asks her if she's already had an interview with the probation office. Partigian interprets her response.
Yes, the detail was that when they were interviewing me, they had the paper of another person. It wasn't my paper.
They had the wrong person?
Sí,
me dijeron que yo estaba en el Paso, Texas, y que me agarraron en la frontera con marihuana. Yo no soy esa persona.
They said that they arrested me in Paso, Texas, and that I had possession of marijuana. That's not me.
It's a mistake that Yeager can get fixed, but the exchange shows the kind of critical errors that could plague a case if attorney and client can't properly communicate. Afterwards, Partigian explains that's why she does what she does.
If I was in a country where I didn't speak the language and are being accused of something, I would like somebody to be able to help me understand what my attorney is saying.
Essentially, she's an intermediary in the sacred lawyer-client relationship. The stakes are high, since any mistake on her part could have lasting consequences. But there isn't much time to think about that for now. She's got to get to her next appointment.
If I'm late, then all the others will be late. If I cannot make it, then they call the court interpreter's office.
That's the office that oversees the certified interpreters in Clark County courts. But they're experiencing their own resource crunch. Recently, the 20 Spanish interpreters who contract with the county got a 28% pay cut to their hourly wage.
When I work, I need to be paid the rate that this is worth.
That's Judy Jenner, a certified court interpreter and president of the Nevada Interpreters and Translators Association.
And I think the rate that Clark County is willing to pay now stands in no relation to the level of education and the expertise that you need to do this job.
Jenner is among a handful of interpreters who refuse to sign the new contract with Clark County. Others say they're deliberately cutting back their hours in court to work in the private sector, which can pay three times more. But meanwhile, the need for their services isn't going away.
The reality of America in 2012 is we have these people who don't speak the language. How are we going to give them access? And interpreting is the only way until somebody invents a robot where you push a button and out comes the interpreting.
There are no robots yet, and if there are fewer court interpreters, the already maxed out court system can expect more delays. In Las Vegas, I'm Jude Jaffe Blanc.
NMSU librarian and professor Molly Malloy has made it her mission to gather and file information and numbers from local newspaper reports on the daily count of murders in Juarez. She has created what is called the Frontera List, a detailed record of the victims, including their name, age, gender, and where they were killed. She is also the co-editor of the book El Sicario, the autobiography of a Mexican assassin, which is being reviewed next week by the Brannigan Library, and the Fountain Theater is showing a movie based on the book as well.
Tell me why and how you started documenting deaths on the border.
Well, I really started documenting it at the beginning of 2008 because that's when those of us who were interested in Juarez noticed that the deaths were really increasing at a very rapid pace compared to what they had been in the previous years and months. And as far as keeping a daily record of that, around the same time, my friend and who ended up being a co-author, Charles Bowden, was working on a story for a magazine based on this explosion of violence in Juarez. And he started going there and you know, seeing what was happening. And what I did was sort of try to bolster what he was finding out by talking to people in the city, by following the daily numbers of murders. And starting in January and February 2008, it just kept going up. There were obviously some dips and, you know, times when it went down, but it's almost steadily increased from 2008 until the end of 2010. So far this year, the murders are down from what they were in 2010, but they're still at a level that's about five times or six times as high as they ever were in any year before that.
The Mexican government gives numbers on the drug-related murders, but they always say nothing is official. Do you ever find that your numbers really differ greatly from theirs?
Well, they do give numbers on the drug-related murders. One of the things I argue with them most on is how do they define a drug-related murder? And why is a drug-related murder more valid to count than other murders? And the other reason that I doubt some of the statistics that they provide is that the Mexican government consistently says that 90% of the people killed are criminals, and yet there are also reports from different agencies within the Mexican government saying that about 95% of these crimes are not investigated. So without the crime being investigated, it's very difficult for me to believe that they know that 90% of the people are related to drug crime, that they are actually criminals being killed by other criminals. And those are, you know, sort of my paraphrasing of some things that President Calderon and many other Mexican officials have said. Another thing, and this is kind of new information for me, the last official release of data from the Mexican government, and it was official, was in January 2011. And they reported that since President Calderon had taken office, 34,612 people had been killed in their terminology, drug-related or organized crime-related deaths, homicides. Well, and they released a big, huge database. It's available on the President of Mexico's website. And it's been analyzed in the press, both in Mexico and in the United States. And I'm sure academics are looking at it also and trying to analyze it. And they say where murders happen, and they give some of the characteristics of those killings. That was in January 2011. Since then, as far as I know, there has not been an official release from the Mexican government to update that figure. And yet, all during 2011, other government agencies have released reports on the numbers of deaths from murder or homicide overall in Mexico. And those numbers are astonishingly bigger. INEGI, which is the Instituto Nacional de Estadística y Geografía, basically it's like a vital statistics census bureau, kind of comparable to something like that in the United States. They collect statistics from all kinds of social, to count all kinds of things in Mexico. And they released data a while back. I added up the numbers of murders for 2007 through 2010 from those figures. And it added up to about 64,000. Calderon took office in December 2006. So I added up the annual numbers across the country, not just here on the border, but across the country, of all the murders, homicides counted in Mexico for that time period, 2007 through 2010, and it added up to about 67,000 deaths from homicide. Now, INEGI doesn't divide the deaths into drug-related homicides, executions, the kinds of terminology that's used in the drug war. These are just people being murdered. All right, so some of them could be accidental homicides, some of them could be domestic violence, or just, I mean, it sounds terrible, but ordinary homicide all over the world. But still, those are phenomenal numbers. It adds up to a murder rate. That's the number per 100,000, which is the standard measure, so that you can compare violence and murder in countries and places all over the world. It adds up to an overall murder rate for the country of about 30 per 100,000, which is quite high. The United States murder rate is now about somewhere between 6 and 8, I think. But keep in mind that that number of 67,000 people doesn't include 2011 at all. This is a huge number, and it's completely different than the official drug-related homicides
that are
reported.
And why do you think
reported.
That? Why is there such a huge gap
It's
there?
Really very difficult to analyze. For one thing, you're dealing with numbers from different agencies within the Mexican government. And I've looked online. I found several articles in the Mexican press and, you know, other writers in Mexico, analysts of this kind of thing, where they're trying to figure it out, too. One thing is that INEGI, the Statistical Bureau in Mexico, they report murders from death certificates that are officially filed. A forensic medical specialist, like a coroner, will certify that the death came from homicide, and that will be on a on an actual report. The same kind of thing we have here. Everyone who is killed in some sort of violent way or in an accident, an automobile accident or whatever, will have a death certificate where the cause of death will be given. Well, those numbers from INEHI that add up to 67,000 for 4 years of Calderon's term from that data, and the official cause of death is homicide. Now, there are different kinds of homicide that are legally recognized, but those are all murders. Those are all one person killing another person for whatever reason in whatever instance. So I would count those as murders. It's a huge number. Why aren't these kinds of numbers, which are available online, they're available in the Mexican media, why aren't they ever dealt with in our press here in the United States? That follow some of the things I post on my list, the Frontera list. And I know that reporters use those numbers because I sometimes get an email saying, can you give me what your latest tally is for Juarez and things like that. But this is, we're talking nationally in Mexico of something like more than 80,000 people killed since President Calderon took office, whereas the number that's most often cited in our media in the United States is somewhere between 40,000 and 50,000. That's double. That's huge. And also keep in mind that Mexico has about a third of the population of the United States. The U.S. population is about 300 million now. Mexico's population is somewhere between 112 and 115 million. In the United States, generally, homicides have been registering. They've kind of been going down steadily since 1980, from a high of about 23,000 in 1980 down to about 15,000 per year now. And that's out of a population of 300,000. So we're talking about multiplying by 4 or 5 times to get the number of deaths that are currently mm-hmm. happening in Mexico. It's pretty shocking. Another way to compare those numbers, we just commemorated the 10th anniversary of September 11th and the fact that about 3,000 people were killed in that attack on our country. If indeed there have been 80,000 people killed in Mexico over the past 5 years, that is about 20 times or more than 20 times the numbers of people killed on that terrible day 10 years ago in our country, in a country that's a third smaller in population. So I think these numbers are huge. I think what we're seeing in Mexico is not a drug war. Mexico hasn't been attacked by an invading army, but the armed groups in Mexico, grupos armados, or this is often said in the newspaper, that's why I'm using that terminology. The armed groups in Mexico include drug cartel people who are heavily armed, includes the army, which is 100,000 or more strong and also very heavily armed. It includes numerous police forces, federal, state, and municipal. All of those people have arms. In the past 5 years in Mexico, more than 80,000 people have been killed in some kind of violent act of homicide. I think that's a human rights disaster, much more than it is a war or a cartel war. I think it's a war on the Mexican people, and I think a lot of that war is being waged by the Mexican government because they're the ones with the guns. And the research I've done relating to the book that Charles Bowden and I recently published about the life story of a sicario or a drug war criminal, a drug war assassin, a drug cartel assassin. One of the most phenomenal things, I think, about this man's story is not that he was a killer, of course that was a terrible thing, but that he was a killer and his work was officially sanctioned by government agencies. At the same time that he was working as a cartel hitman, he was also working as a state policeman in Chihuahua, in the state of Chihuahua. And this is not uncommon. He is not alone. He estimates that 25% of the policemen trained in the academy where he was trained are already on the payroll of the drug cartels before they even finish their official police training. And he did this double duty, if you will, for more than 20 years and probably killed hundreds of people during that time. And he did it all during the time when Mexico and Juarez were essentially much less violent than they are now.
So for the Frontera list, how do you keep the daily track of the deaths? Where do you get that information?
I mostly follow the tally that comes out from El Diario de Juarez, which is the major daily newspaper in Juarez. I supplement that. I double check with Norte de Ciudad Juarez, which is another daily paper there. And those are the main sources that I use to keep track just of Juarez. And I don't try to keep track of any of the other major cities or places in Mexico. It would essentially take, you know, right, a full-time job instead of, you know, the amount of hours I'm able to devote to it. There are people that follow the national reports that come out in major newspapers in Mexico from Mexico City. The people I know who are following it in the major daily newspapers say that it's not actually reported every day. And we also know from other kinds of news reports that there are many regions in Mexico now where reporters are not reporting drug-related violence at all because they've been intimidated into silence. And in order to protect themselves and their families, they no longer report. There are areas in the country that have been extremely violent this year in 2011, and yet I've never seen any figures on a daily basis or even a cumulative basis as to how many people have been killed, for instance, in the states of Tamaulipas, in the state of Nuevo León or Coahuila, which are border states to the east of us. So I don't know if the daily tally that's provided is accurate. I just know that I think keeping it consistently I've been doing it now since early 2008. I think the consistency of the reports in Diario that I then report out, I think it's a fairly reliable number. It's probably not exact, but it might be as good as we're going to get on a daily basis.
So who uses this list?
Well, as of this morning, I just looked, and there are 894 subscribers.
My goodness.
So it's kind of a lot of people. Now, I don't know if everybody reads it every day. That's a lot of people. And I don't think they all read it every day. When every now and then I can look, as the administrator of the list, I can see how many people have gone to the list online in the past several hours or whatever. But I'd say consistently those reports are over 200 people per day going to the website. And since it's also an email list, it functions as a news group, meaning you can read it online through the Google News Group Frontera list, or you can just read it with what comes to your email. So all I can say is basically about 800 people are signed up. At least 200 of them, I think, look at it every day.
This month's Brannigan Library Book Review is El Sicario, the autobiography of a Mexican assassin by Molly Malloy and Charles Bowden. A book discussion on Tuesday, May 8th will cover many details of the Southwest Border Book Award winner. For more information, call 528-4000. I'm Vanessa Dobovich. Thanks for tuning in to Fronteras, a Changing America.